This is Deborah Beck, professor of ancient Greek literature in the Department of Classics at the University of Texas at Austin. My students and I are excited to welcome you to our podcast, Musings in Greek Literature. Welcome to the last episode of season 3 of Musings in Greek Literature. This is episode 8, and I'm Professor Deborah Beck. I am joined once again by Bill Ferris, who is a current graduate student in classical literature at the University of Texas at Austin, and also by Becca Vanderhorst, who received her PhD from the University of Texas in 2019. We're going to be talking about book 4 of the Argonautica, which is by far the longest book of the poem. In a lot of ways, it also has the largest range. It has the largest geographical range. It has the most number of truly supernatural creatures and events in it. So in some ways, it reminds all of us of book 2 in the sense that it's so wide ranging that it can be hard to really figure out what it's about. But at the same time, it's very clearly about the journey home, getting from Colchis back to Greece and all these crazy things that happen on the way there. So thank you again, Bill and Becca, for being with us. For those of you who are joining us for the first time in episode 8, Bill introduced himself a little bit more length in episode 1 and Becca in episode 2. So I encourage you to check that out if you want to learn more about our awesome guests. So we're going to turn our attention now to the invocation in book 4. When Becca and I were recording episode 2, we talked initially about, well, there's no invocation and isn't that weird? But then we realized, no, it's not weird, because if all you have looked at is book 1, there's no particular reason to expect an invocation in book 2. It's only when you get to the invocation in book 4 and you realize that all of the books of the poem except book 2 have an invocation. It's only in retrospect that you realize that there wasn't one in book 2. So let's take a look at this invocation, y'all, and see how the muse is addressed and what kind of, as it were, topic sentence for what's going to happen in book 4 is provided by this invocation. First of all, it's pretty short. It's just the 5 verses, and then we get started. In the first line, the goddess that's addressed is Thea, which is the same as the invocation at the beginning of the Iliad. And there's a little note in the always helpful translation of William Race to say, well, maybe this is Erato, the same goddess of love who is, or muse of love rather, who's addressed at the beginning of the invocation of book 3, or maybe it's the sort of more general muse that readers would be familiar with from these kinds of direct addresses to a goddess at the beginning of the Iliad or the Odyssey. So I'm interested in hearing from y'all, the thing that's really striking to me about this, not only this kind of who is this goddess? This is a much more sort of normal looking way of addressing the goddess. It seems like this speaker needs more help, wants more help in telling the story than the one who said in the beginning of book 1, I'm going to tell the story, or the one who said in book 3, Erato, stand next to me, not tell the story, but kind of stand here and, you know, help me if I get confused or something. So there's that. There's clearly a more central and active role being played by the muse who's being addressed. But there's also a different way of talking about Medea's involvement. So in book 3, the invocation says, tell us about how Jason acquired the fleece because of the love of Medea. And that sounds like, okay, that's cool. That's heroic and fun, whatever. But this invocation sort of intertwines good things and bad things. So in the first line, it says, tell me about the kamatos, the sort of toil or struggle or difficulty, and the Danaea, the counsels, the clever ideas. So these things are sort of woven together all through book 4, that Medea is going to suffer and also that she's going to play a really central role in making plans and figuring out how to get the Argonauts from point A to point B. So I'm curious to hear from either or both of you, like, how do you read this invocation as the third in a series in relation to the ones we've had in book 1 and book 3.
I think it's also, he's very clear, the narrator, that he says a little later on, for truly the mind within me whirls in speechless stupor as I ponder whether to call it the lovesick affliction of obsession or shameful panic, which made Medea leave the Colchian people. And it's interesting for a couple of reasons. You know, Deborah just briefly mentioned in book one that it's, I shall recall these stories, you know, this very clear focus. Whereas three, it's like, you know, Erato, stand by me and tell this story. And now he's like, I have no clue what to say. So I need you to tell the story. It's this kind of weird evolution, but also that this invocation is not as comprehensive as the other ones have been. So the invocation of book one very much kind of gives a clear picture of what's happening in book one and two. The invocation of book three does foreshadow what happens in basically the entirety of book three. Then you get to book four and it's just like, why did Medea leave? You know, was it because she's in love or because she's panicked? And it's much more kind of pointing at a single event, which is also very unusual, I think.
That's a great point. I never thought of that. And of course, it's making an artificial distinction. It's saying, was it A or B? And I would say the answer is it was A and B.
And I think too, I've never noticed this before, but thinking of gender, I believe in some earlier episodes it was talked about in book three, we go from these Homeric ideals of of heroism and realize that Medea has a lot to do with saving everybody. But what I've never noticed before, Dr. Beck, you mentioned the Iliad reference in line one here, Thea, but the second line sounds like the Odyssey. The Odyssey begins, Andramoi in epemusa, tell me of the man, O muse. But here, Apollonia says, Colchidos in epemusa, even in the same places are the words tell and muse. And so it's a combination of the first line of the Odyssey and the first line of the Iliad, except maybe that Odyssey reference is pointed. There it's tell me of the male person. And here we want to hear about a girl. And really in Homeric epic, I mean, we get to hear from the women every once in a while, but they're not in invocations. So that stands out a bit.
You're right. It really does. You know, I know you've been doing a great class this semester called Dangerous Women that I had an extremely awesome time visiting a couple of weeks ago. And thinking about Medea as a hero of the Argonautica is something that is a prominent thread in both just, you know, a reader who picks up the poem and looks at it is really going to be struck by how much Medea does to make everything happen. And that's also a question that scholars talk about a lot. Is Medea the real hero of the poem? And they, you know, argue back and forth in scholarly journals about whether she is or not. And Bill, I think you make a great point here to say that Apollonius is using references to epic structures that an audience back in the third century BCE would totally recognize as pointing directly to the beginnings of the Iliad and of the Odyssey to say, you better believe Medea is an important hero of what's going to happen. And Becca, you're so right that this is this tiny little, you know, why did the first thing in book four happen? And then, you know, 25 more things are going to happen that are completely not referred to in the invocation at all. Yeah.
Well, and then, I mean, the narrator also seems to have a greater presence throughout book four. He shows up repeatedly like, oh, and this is, you know, I don't know what to do with this scene either, you know? And so it's almost like the narrator is giving more kind of snapshots throughout as opposed to kind of having more just at the beginning of the book that like he did in the other ones.
Yeah. So this one's more of a sort of turn in, tune in for coming attractions or something. I don't know. Bill, you're laughing.
That's right. I was just going to say too, one of my favorite small invocations there is when they get later to Drepane, which is the name for the island where the Phaiakians are, where Jason and Medea are going to get married. Apollonius, the scholar, says he has to tell you about the name of the island. And he has to apologize to the muses. He calls them to apologize because he has to tell the story of Cronus getting castrated by a scythe. And Drepane is the word for scythe. And therefore, the island is called that word. But it's a strange moment where he has to apologize to them for what he's going to say.
Yeah, that's a great way to think about it. There is much more awareness in all kinds of ways about the presence of the narrator. And it's not like the narrator has exactly been shy up until now. Starting from the very beginning of the first book, the narrator has been extremely assertive about saying, hello, I'm the narrator. And if you're thinking I'm the Homeric kind of narrator who just kind of lurks around the edges of the story, you are wrong, my friends. But there's a whole other level of sort of, watch me try to narrate. Look at how hard this is. You know, while the Argonauts are struggling through the sand in Libya or having any of their other just extremely taxing and life-threatening adventures, it's almost like the narrator is having an equally life-threatening experience as a narrator. I mean, it's not literally life-threatening, but trying to say, you know, my task has gotten harder while these characters are doing this incredibly challenging thing. So one of the things that strikes me about book four's invocation and different from book three is that the book three invocation mentions both Jason and Medea. And this one only mentions Medea. So there's a real sense in which this one is elevating or centering Medea more than or differently from Jason. So Bill, particularly given that you've been teaching Medea in this class, how would you kind of trace Medea or think about her development as a character in book four, either within book four or and how that develops the way we saw her arrive on the scene and behave in book three?
I think really the first scene we see her in book four at starting in line six, right after the invocation, we see Medea, and it's a scene that's very reminiscent of parts of book three. Here she is, in Race's words, into Medea's heart, Hera cast excruciating fear. She's scared and she's running away from her family. But she also has these, she's like going back and forth, not sure what to do. And eventually about line 20, 21 or so, it's through Hera's designs that she's driven to flee, and she actually does it. This is reminiscent of book three. It's about line 800 or so, where Medea is about to kill herself at night, and then Hera puts it into her mind, no, you're going to help Jason. And so we see this Medea that, I think Apollonius captures Medea at the end of the Euripides play, where Medea is struggling. Should I kill my kids? Should I not kill my kids? Should I do it? And we see that same kind of whirling around in Medea's mind here. And so I think if we trace Medea through book four, it's exactly what Dr. Beck was saying in this first line. What we're both going to see is a Medea that is torn between these crazy feelings of, I love Jason. What did I do to my family? Can I do these terrible things? But also fear that her father's going to be after her. But also, she's a wise and cunning character who knows how to, almost like an Odysseus, she's got that metis, that skill. This first section, I said, starting at about line six, she's going to go to the Argonauts and she's going to plea with them to take her back to Greece, away from her family. And one of the things is, even as she's going, running away to the Argonauts, I think what she's singing songs and using her magic, and doors are opening in front of her. So all of a sudden we see this in book three, we saw Medea who told Jason how to use magic. And here we just see her, you know, bursting through doors, opening up their own accord in front of her. And then we have, they come to where the Golden Fleece is at about line 150. It's protected by this giant snake. And it is about line 149 that Jason is afraid of this snake. And Medea just comes and puts it asleep. And so we see here this example of, we start out with Medea running away from her family in fear, but at the same time, she's the character who has the skill and the bravery to face this terrible monster and actually get the fleece.
Yeah. And that happens again and again. I mean, all the way to the end of book four, where she's the one who kills Talus, the giant that prevents them from landing on the island of Crete in the like last 100 lines of the poem or something like that. She has the incantation and she does the magic thing, whatever, and the giant falls down dead. So that's the first thing, and it's almost the last thing in the book too.
Yeah, I've always loved that genitive absolute in the snake scene that's on 163, cures caclomenes. So, you know, with the girl telling him to do it, Jason grabs the fleece. Like even the moment when he finally gets the fleece, it's at her command. It's a really kind of a deceptively powerful genitive absolute at the start of that line right there.
That makes me think too, that right in Argonautica 1, before they even set sail, they have this big scene where they say, who are we going to elect as our leader? And, you know, Jason ends up, and sometimes Heracles is telling them what to do, but here it's Medea. I'm going to tell you what to do. And it makes me think of the Lemnian women who were also very, you know, wise and good at ruling and making decisions. So it's interesting to see that kind of theme earlier in book one coming out more in book four.
One of the things I think we can see in how important women characters are, especially Medea, but also Hypsipyle, the queen of the Lemnian women, and Chalciope, Medea's sister, and various other female characters that are encountered on their travels. Those women, as y'all have just been saying, give us a certain view of Jason and how he gets things done. So as you guys were both just saying, it's not like Jason rushes forward when the golden fleece is in view and says, oh, great, the quest is ended and I'm awesome and let's be heroic. He's afraid. Medea enchants the snake and then she tells him what to do. So that kind of situation, I think, makes it really clear, not that we didn't already know this, but it says it again as something we should be expecting as we begin book four, that Jason's heroism is impossible without Medea, that Jason's accomplishments rely and depend on her. And that is fundamental to the way the poem depicts heroes and depicts Jason. So Becca, I know that you have a soft spot in your heart for heroes because of how much time you spent thinking about that on your dissertation. So what are your thoughts about how Jason conducts himself, we might say, in book four, and how that resembles, differs from, draws to a conclusion, the Jason that we've been spending so much time with in the rest of the poem up until now?
Yeah, I like to think of book four sometimes as the book that destroys Jason and then rebuilds him. Right before we had our discussion here, I listened to the episode 3 podcast by Kate and Dylan, which was just excellent, especially for undergrads. It was amazing. But I think it was Dylan in particular was really focusing on Jason as someone who gets help from others. He's not this normal hero. He's someone who depends on others, who focuses on mediation and relies on the people around him in order to accomplish his tasks. And to that, I would also add that in addition to making agreements with people, he's also very interested in finding kind of commonality for his crew. You know, some scholars have even used the word democratic for Jason in a kind of a tepid way. But he is kind of this person who is interested in making sure that everyone's on the same page, if you will. And that really changes at the start of book four. So right after the scene we were looking at where they get the fleece, the description, I'm just going to read Brace's translation here. The description of Jason having it is sometimes he went draping it over his left shoulder from the top of his neck to his foot, which is very much kind of like a Heraclean lion skin figure, which is not Jason at all. And then more importantly, it continues to say, and this is right around line 179, it says, but at other times he rolled it up and stroked it, for he greatly feared that some man or god would come and take it from him. And then shortly after that, when he gets to the ship and says, all right, here's the fleece, all the men are like, oh my gosh, it's so pretty, I want to touch it. He's like, no, it's mine. And he hides it away. So you see a Jason who's no longer interested in common, that famous xunos adjective that he's always using. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the absurdist scene, where like Kate and Dylan were looking at, he's very interested in making agreements with people and mediating. And yet in the absurdist scene, which is just a quick summary for those who are less familiar with the scene, absurdist is Medea's brother, and he is sent out with a Colchian contingent to bring Medea back. And Jason and the Argonauts are surrounded by absurdist's forces. And so at first, Jason makes an agreement with Absyrtus that he is going to be able to keep the fleece, but he will hand over Medea to the arbitration of a local king to decide what should happen to her. So he does start to make an agreement. Then Medea's like, what? You're going to abandon me? And it gets kind of, you know, scary Euripidean vibes of, you know, I'm going to kill everything if you do that. And so then Jason comes up with this new plan with Medea that turns the elements of diplomacy upside down and taints everything. So they give Absyrtus gifts of hospitality. They tell him they're going, or actually at first it's just supposed to be Medea and him meeting, but Jason sneaks in. But they also say that Medea will meet him at Artemis's temple. So it's a sacred ground where you shouldn't have, you know, like treachery or killing. And then Jason hides in ambush. And as Medea and Absyrtus are talking with these gifts and with this special place, he comes out from behind a bush and just kills Absyrtus. And so you see a Jason, you know, all of those amazing ideals that he's had thus far with, you know, making connections with foreigners and people and getting their help. And then the commonality of his crew, both, all of those things are kind of collapsing at the start of book four, which is really fascinating in terms of building up a new heroic character and then making him turn against those characteristics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. If I can go back to this scene you just talked about, Becca, where Jason comes up with the plan to kill Absyrtus. What I find so amazing is that, right, there's this pact, this agreement made with the Argonauts and the Colchians, but Medea wasn't in on it. And so this, you mentioned she gets all Euripidean. It's a speech she gives, starts at line 355 and goes to 390. That's a really long speech. She says things like, somewhere around line 382 in Race's translation, may Zeus's wife, the all-ruling queen in whom you glory, never accomplish that, your homecoming. May you remember me someday when you're racked by troubles. She's really angry. And what I find amazing about Jason here is look at this. The speech ends at 391. Thus she spoke, seething with bitter rage, she longed to burn up the ship, to destroy everything completely and throw herself into the raging fire. So this is what we were just talking about. Medea, not only in trouble, but she's ready to kill herself and everybody in flames. Mm-hmm. And Jason, calm yourself, poor girl. And all of a sudden we realize, or at least he tries to make it appear to Medea in this speech he has at 395, that he's already figured out a plan. Oh, well, we had to do this because the indigenous people around are for the Colchians, and so we have to surprise them. And yeah. What I find interesting is that the narrator hasn't let us privy to that plan in Jason's mind yet. And so we can get wrapped in it with Medea and feel for her. And then we can also see it shines this good light on Jason, where he appears to have already thought everything out.
Yeah. Or there's the flip side that Jason may be lying, that no, he never was planning to help Medea, but after hearing her freaky speech, so a little bit of devil's advocate there of how much you want to trust Jason. But yeah, absolutely. It's just such a fascinating little exchange between the two. We've been talking a lot about how this is foreshadowing Medea and Euripides' Medea. But it's also foreshadowing a lot of Jason and his kind of behavior in the Euripidean media as well, with kind of his clever words and trying to continually put her down from what she's planning on doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And what do y'all think about, like, when they get stuck in the desert? I basically sort of feel like I've been buried under a sand dune with all of the supernatural things that happen and all the wandering around in circles they do. I mean, one of the things that struck me when I reread book four to prepare for this is that basically the first half of the book accomplishes nothing. At the beginning of the book, they're trying to run away together from Colchis with the fleece. And then they they failed exactly to run away the way they had intended, because they are chased by the Colchians. They kill Absyrtus. They incur a ritual pollution, which is very terrible. And then eventually they arrive at the island of Drepane that Bill talked about earlier, closely pursued by the Colchians. And that's where the first thing that's actually kind of a change in their status happens, because that's where they actually get married. So where they're forced to get married, because again, a female character kind of takes the lead in things turning out the way they're going to turn out. And so the queen of Drepane, Arete, whom audiences would be familiar with from her substantial and somewhat enigmatic appearances in the Odyssey, finds out what the situation is, which is that they've agreed to hand Medea back to the Colchians if she and Jason haven't slept together. That's what Alcinous decides he's going to do when he hears their story. And so Arete tattles. She goes to Medea and tells her this and says, you better have sex with that guy if you don't want to get sent back. So this is yet another example of the woman sort of taking the lead. So after they celebrate this kind of hasty, oopsie wedding where they both had wanted to be married in Greece, but they couldn't wait that long, they end up in this sort of surreal landscape of misery in the Libyan desert. Whenever I read this, I just really struggle with it. The last third of the book is just sand dunes and terrible snakes and visions of Heracles. And like, what do either of you make of that as the sort of, as it were, the culmination, which it is in some sense, because there's only about 100 verses left of the poem by the time they finally get out of Libya and are on the ocean again on their way back to Greece.
Well, I've always thought of Libya as actually the culmination of all of the heroic discussions that have been happening in the book thus far. You know, you just have Jason, who has turned kind of against his collective sort of ideals. And, you know, throughout this text, there's been kind of this, you know, this fight, if you will, this undercurrent tension with kind of older heroic models and newer heroic models. And I think that there's that scene, though, where they're dying on the shores of Libya. They've given up. They're ready to die. And then the heroines show up and give them this like really weird thing about carrying the bones of their mother or something weird like that. And Jason, after he talks with them, he says, well, gosh darn, I can't figure this out myself. So I'm going to go to the crew members that we've just all separated from. For the council of many is better. And the word used there is metis, which Odysseus is always the solo metis dude. And now it's like this collective metis. And then what they end up doing, saving themselves, is not Heracles rowing the boat by himself, but everyone working together to save the boat and carrying it on their shoulders. So you have this collective strength, this collective metis that is reestablishing Jason as a hero of cooperation and collective values. So the description that the narrator is, it's one of the most epic descriptions, actually. The narrator comes back and brings the muses into the account, and the description of them carrying it is just one of the most epic scenes in the text. So if you want to read it, it's roughly around 1381, but it is just so epic, saying these people carried this boat, and I'm telling you, this is the truth. So it's one of the most heroic culminations in the entire text.
If I can give another view that I think complements that, one thing I think of with the Libya scenes is it reminds me all of a sudden that Apollonius of Rhodes has connections to the Ptolemies in Egypt, and that Homer, Hesiod, Euripides, we think, mainland Greece, Ionia, and then all of a sudden we have this Ptolemaic Egyptian world come in. And I think one way we see this is that there's an Argonaut named Euphemus who is given by this water god Triton a clump of land from Africa. And why this is going to be important is because one of the last scenes of the epic, starting at about 1731, there's this strange scene where Euphemus has a dream about this clod of earth, and it falls into the ocean. I think he dreamed that it was nursing at his breast. But he gets his dream to him that this clod of earth is going to become the island of Thera, and that his own descendants from Lemnos that he must have engendered in book one are going to come to Thera someday. And then those people from Thera are going to come back and colonize Cyrene in Africa. And this is a big, it's a colony that's debated in Herodotus and Pindar. Was it the Spartans who colonized it? Was it the Therans, et cetera? And so I think the idea that Thera, the island, plays an important role in the story of this colonization of North Africa by the Greeks way before Apollonius's time. The fact that the land the Therans come from in the Argonautica is actually Africa helps Apollonius tie in that, like, go back and say, yes, this is ancient Greek history, but we've also got this Egyptian connection to it.
One of the other things that really strikes me, and I'd like to now turn our attention to the last few verses of the poem, it really strikes me that the poem doesn't narrate their return to their home in Iolcos. The last place where they do anything is the island of Aegina, which is just off the coast of Athens, which is in Greece, but it's not that close to where the Argonauts set out from. And as soon as they do that, then the poem says, hooray, we're done, y'all did a great job. And then the very last line, 1781, says, you set foot on Pagasai, so you did get home. But it's almost like it's an afterthought. So I wonder, Bill, I know you told me when we were talking about recording this episode how much you like this part of the poem. This is also a part of the poem that my students read in Greek. So I want for them, I want to make sure that we talk about this. They read all of book three in Greek, which for those who haven't read Apollonius in Greek is an absolutely astonishing accomplishment for a group of undergraduates who are as exhausted as everybody is right now after 2 years of pandemic learning. And they not only did that, but they also read the beginning and the end of book four. So big shout out to my students for their fantastic work. And I want to end this season with a discussion of this passage, which we also talked about in our class. So Bill, do you want to kick that off? Because I'm confident you have a lot of cool things to say about it.
Thank you. Yeah, I find this ending both very tidy in some ways and very frustrating in other ways. and so one way that it's tidy is that there's a lot of ring composition going on. And by this, I mean Apollonius uses specific language to tie into earlier parts of the story to give a closural effect here. And specifically, he's going to use language that points back to the very beginning because we're at the end. So for instance, at the beginning of this ending section, 1773, Hilat aristeon makaron genas haide da oidai, be gracious, you race of blessed heroes. So when he calls them the race of blessed heroes, I think it's an echo of book one, line 548. I'll just read that line. Nea kai he mitheon andron genos. That word genos again, which is race. There in book one, it's the race of demigod men. But in book one, that's a scene of all the gods watching from a mountaintop while the Argo shoots off from the sea. And so if we have this ring composition bringing us back to the moment the Argo is leaving the beach of Pagasai, then we have this feeling of closure there. And it's important that Pagasai is the second to last word of the poem, too. So they come back to where they left. But also the word ethlos in 1776, they reached the end of their voyage since no further trial ethlos befell you as you returned home from Aegina. I think that points back to the proem. And I know ethlos is a common word, but if you look at the book one proem, line 15 or so, tells you that as soon as Peleus saw Jason and suspected he was going to kill him in the future, he took note and arranged for him the ordeal of a very arduous voyage so that either on the sea or else among foreign people, he would lose any chance of returning home. And the word for ordeal there is aethlon. And so this has this nice and tidy connection to the proem. Okay, Phileas set an ordeal for them, and there are no more ordeals, and they've returned home. And in fact, Phileas was unsuccessful because they did make a return home. But it's frustrating because, as Dr. Beck says, they just get there and it's like, the end. And we're like, what?
I love that. I love all those different connections that you're drawing to this whole poem. And I suspect that at least some of our listeners are thinking, that's ridiculous. How would anybody keep their focus on those kind of minute details over such a large span of poetry? But that is exactly the kind of deeply attentive reading, deeply informed by conventions of past poetry and specific contents of past poetry that Apollonius's audience would absolutely have had, and in fact would have delighted in. So Becca, what for you, like, what is the ending, as it were, that is created by this sort of sign-off passage from the narrator?
Yeah, I mean, to add to something that Bill was saying, there's also this return to the idea of poetry and songs and everything as something that is in a tradition of people telling stories. So, you know, in book one, it talks about how the songs of former bards talk about how Argus, the ship, was built according to Athena's instructions, and how he's not going to tell that story because other people have. And at the end here, he says, you know, may these songs year after year be sweeter for men to sing. So returning to the idea of kind of the tradition of literature, because, I mean, by this point, of course, it was literature that they were reading, not necessarily just listening to, but a tradition of literature that lasts, that is told, that, I mean, even now, how much later, 2000 plus years later, we're still reading it. And I would say it's still becoming sweeter. I mean, the scholarship on the Argonautica has exploded in the last, I don't know, Deborah, would you say the last 70 years? Like 1950?
Yeah, kind of since Karspeckin in the mid-50s. Mm-hmm. I think that was kind of the
and
start where people stopped saying Apollonius is a failed Virgil and started really enjoying his work on its own terms.
Yes, I mean, I would say that it has been a sweet, you know, experience learning not just about the Argonautica, but also about the scholarship on this text that has gotten so much richer year by year, with new kind of interest in this literature, this text that is just so complex and so beautiful and so wrapped up with the idea of what literature is and what it is intended for its audiences to read. And so I think that it is a fascinating ending by returning to that theme he brought up kind of tangentially in book one. And then at the end, very much kind of like an Ovidian thing too. I mean, he does many, many Roman authors do the same thing of, I want this to be a lasting remembrance.
Yeah. We usually end every episode, as you both know from having done this before, with a reflection on the experience of doing this. And for me, I'm having such a happy, proud teacher moment because both of you first encountered Apollonius in graduate seminars with me, Becca in 2013 and Bill in 2019. And Becca was a guest instructor in Bill's seminar when she was still a graduate student herself. And Becca, the class absolutely was beside themselves. They loved it. They were hanging on your every word. That was one of our absolutely most successful classes. And I'm teaching the seminar again this fall, and Bill's going to give a guest presentation. I guarantee the same thing is going to happen. And if I am a very fortunate and happy teacher, you know, 3 years from now, I will be advising the Apollonius dissertation of one of the students whose socks are going to get knocked off by Bill sometime next October. So, you know, for me, the effort of really trying to embrace Apollonius on his own terms, which started, as it does for so many people, I think, with an effort to understand Apollonius as something that Virgil was using to figure out, to think about how to tell the story of the Aeneid. And I quickly left that behind and became really interested in what Apollonius is doing on his own terms. And, you know, it's a real privilege for me to have had so many opportunities to explore Apollonius with students you know, graduate students like you two who helped me see new things in the poem with my undergraduates this semester, who worked so hard under such challenging conditions to just, you know, read a ton of Greek, make these terrific episodes where they learn from each other and they helped each other. I would like to think, this is kind of sappy, but I don't care. I would really like to think that this was something that Apollonius would appreciate, that his poem helped people to become better readers, to become that different, more sort of thoughtful thinkers, at the same time as it also really immersed people in the visceral sensations of Medea's emotions, which is explored in several of the episodes that the undergraduates made about book three.
I think too that this book, the more that I've thought about it, has been, well, both pleasurable but also frustrating. And you speak about Virgil. I came from reading a lot of Virgil and got excited about the Argonautica because I could hear Virgil in it. For instance, the invocation to Erato at the beginning of book three, I just happened to have written a paper, I don't know, sometime in undergrad on the beginning of book seven of the Aeneid, where he says, "Nunc age erato." But the more I look into the Argonautica and try to push Virgil aside, it's just, I think as you can see from these podcasts, there's a lot going on under the surface. And maybe we can liken it to this theme we've talked about in the Argonautica of group effort. That's one of the huge themes that's something that helps me understand this poem. It's the group effort of looking at it and talking through it with other people. So, yeah.
Well, thank you both for being such a great group. I've really enjoyed the whole series, but getting a chance to make podcasts with each of you separately and then with both of you together, I've been looking forward to this recording all semester long, and it's been as much fun as I thought it would be, which is really saying something. So thank you again to our listeners for being with us on this voyage of the Argo. If you enjoyed our podcast, we hope you'll leave us a comment and a review, and we look forward to seeing you for our next season. I don't know yet what that's going to be, but there will be a trailer for season four in due time. So thank you again to my wonderful graduate students, Bill, and former graduate student, Becca, to my undergraduates, Cade, Liberty, Dylan, Natalie, and Ava. And thank you to you listeners. Bye for now.